Good evening. This is Mae Brussel. The title of this one-hour broadcast is World Watchers. It is program number 819, August the 17th, 1987. As I mentioned before and will repeat for those listeners who are used to getting the tapes or hearing this program on other radio stations, after 16 and a half years on the air, I'm changing the format of my research. And World Watchers, the way it is presented now by subscription with tapes going to other stations or individually, will cut off at broadcast number 825, September the 28th, which is 6 weeks from now. I might have mentioned there's about 20 reasons for making this change, and I'm very excited about them. And maybe at the end of that last broadcast, as the tapes go out by subscription, I will give you some of those 20 reasons. As I said before, the tapes are available from 1977 to 1987, the past broadcast, so you can order those back tapes if you want to study the material that I have on the air. Remember, Kazoo will continue its format with 1 hour of news and 1 hour of talk show, but I'm also going to change it and have guests, just as I did Bo Greitz last week. It was a very popular program. People liked it very much, and I may have a guest for 1 or 2 hours and then also take calls and have people from all over the country, various researchers and writers and people that you may want to share your time with, and the locals will have advantage of that. There are no more sheets going out by request, no longer with the bibliography and the material for what you heard on the air, and there are no articles being copied by request. I'm just not able to answer all the mail, and while I would be able to do this, I don't want to do it. I want to start writing. The only exception to this statement that applies is people who have used the material in some way that is noticeable to me, not to themselves, but to me. The Iran-Contra affair has been going on since October the 5th, 1986, almost a year now, since Eugene Hasenfuss landed in Nicaragua. There are talk shows around the country from coast to coast and up north, south, east, and west. There are very few people that use this material in any form on any talk show that I know of, with the exception of Willard Harris up in Berkeley. I hope he doesn't mind my mentioning his name. He'll call and ask me about certain questions if a guest is on Larry King, the television, or otherwise, if there's important talk shows or guests, people in the area that are controversial, and we share material, and he has called up and used the name of Mae Brussel as being knowledgeable on this material. And nobody that I know of, I haven't had a response from people who have all of this, get it in the mail, then put it in a drawer or on the wall and don't use it. And they had ample opportunity during the Iran-Contra hearings to call in to Washington and share it with Pacifica or other talk shows in their area. And I really feel that if it's going to sit somewhere on a table or between the ears of people, it is a lot of work to be shelved that way. And if it's not going to be used in that way, I'm going to write, and I'll be very satisfied to do that. Plus, I'm going to continue for the people in the listening area, those that can have the radios to pick it up. I feel stronger than ever about my local community, about the people in Watsonville, Santa Cruz, down to Big Sur, and the areas all around. I'm very happy with that. So that is the area I'm going to share with on the air, and the rest I will write about. Week from Friday on August 31st, Daniel Sheehan is coming here to Monterey Peninsula to talk about the Christic Institute. He's going to share his information on the secret team that he's studied for 25 years, beginning with the Contra War in Cuba in 1959. The key person, of course, being Robert Mayhew there of the Hughes Organization and Richard Nixon. He will be speaking at the new forum. They're going to have a luncheon downtown at the Monterey Sheraton. It'll be at 12 noon. The reservations are $13. It has to be paid in advance. Call 625-9967 or write the New Forum, P.O. Box 22214, Carmel, California, 93922. He doesn't get this way very often, and this is an opportunity for the people around here to see a man who has taken the information about assassinations, drug running, and covert operations and put it into a court case. It's probably the most important case that I can think of in the United States, not at the present time, but probably the first one of its kind in a court of law, because the Warren Commission and the House Select Committee on Assassinations were not legal activities. They were just hanky-panky and hocus-pocus. I got a lot of telephone calls at home last week after I had Bo Greitz on the air asking for where they could get his videotape of Kung Sa and the drug dealer, the drug king in Burma, and his desperation in dealing with people like Richard Armitage, the deputy director of defense under Weinberger, and Theodore Shackley, and of course we know the Shackley-Klein Secord Hakim network, and Eric von Marbart. Kung Sa talks about that with Bo Greitz on his tape. The address, again, that I gave last week is the American Freedom Information Network, 2140 West Chapman Avenue, number 223, Orange, California, 92668. And I believe the videotape was $6, allow for tax and postage. Also, I want to tell you one more time about the book that came out of James Earl Ray. It's called Tennessee Waltz, and I suggest you get that. There's a lot of important information. And you can write to St. Andrews Press, St. Andrews, Tennessee, 37372. The publisher of this book has disappeared, according to Ted Gandolfo in New York, and hasn't been located since this book came out. I have a letter that was written to James Earl Ray in the prison in November of 1970. It's dated 78, and it came from a person. I'll read it to you, and it's interesting because it involved J. Edgar Hoover and the Martin Luther King assassination. It was sent to me by Ted Gandolfo and from James Earl Ray. Dear Mr. Ray, I'm sending you a copy of a letter that was sold at auction last summer in Surrey, England. It belonged to the distinguished British art expert Cosmo Morkaus, who passed away 2 years ago. The letter was written by J. Edgar Hoover, and it brought about $50, Hoover's letter to Cosmo Morkaus. This letter could prove very damaging to the FBI. As you can see, it mentions you, James Earl Ray, and a William Fox, the wizard artist whose petition for your release was suppressed by J. Edgar Hoover himself. This is listed. I got your address from, he goes into the Bureau of Records. I wish you freedom. And the address of William Fox is on North Broadway. Ted Gandolfo tried to find him, couldn't locate him. Lucian Perdell, it looks like Perdell, wrote to James Earl Ray at Brushy Mountain State Prison, 1978. And this is a letter from the U.S. Department of Justice from J. Edgar Hoover to Mr. Cosmo, it's Monkhouse, not Morkaus, curator, in care of the Hampshire House, 150 Central Park South. Dear Mr. Monkhouse, we are interested in acquiring any of the original prints and master drawings that evidently he purchased of William Fox, the elusive and wizard figurative art of sculpture. We are chiefly interested in his innovative and caustic monotype drawing of James Earl Ray, Fire Island Athletes, and his print titled Crossfire, which depicts the assassination of President Kennedy. Rest assured, I will personally arrange to have any amount of money, our tax dollars, paid to you upon receipt of these drawings in question. They are of vital concern. Yours truly, J. Edgar Hoover. Now, that letter sold for $50, but what was in the drawings of William Fox, or how Mr. Monkhouse happened to obtain them, goodness knows they seem very valuable and may be an important part of the assassination of Martin Luther King. Now, I want to run down with you some of the top stories in the news because I separated approximately 78 main subjects or categories, and of course, it's impossible in 1 hour to even touch all of that. So I thought I would just share with you, and I've wanted to do it many, many times over, just to put them in the order of the pile that I cut them and let you see what a researcher finds in the course of 12 hours of cutting paper sometimes, and then separating them to the very most important, then the important, and then the eventually. I'm going to share some of the very most important that I cut just this week. First, I want to cite an article in the LA Times. It's titled, Says They Confer for 30 Minutes Daily. Carlucci tells of briefing the president. National Security Advisor Frank Carlucci said Thursday he gives Reagan rather than less information, even more than he wants to know, in contrast to Rear Admiral Poindexter, who deliberately withheld information. Carlucci said that he tells the president, he talks to him, he's a career diplomat who served as deputy to the heads of both the Pentagon and CIA, and I'll do more on that later. He said, my responsibility is to tell him what he needs to know. Is the president of the United States on a need-to-know basis? He said, how is the president to learn if no one tells him? A president is somewhat circumscribed in the way he gets information. He's dependent on the people around him to come forward with information, such as White House Chief of Staff Howard Baker. Baker and I give him, I'd say, more than he wants in a small time. He's getting more than he wants on a need to know in 30 minutes a day. The president of the United States gets that. Now, Carlucci was deputy director of the CIA under Jimmy Carter. Then after the rescue, hostage rescue effort failed, and I'll go into Carlucci a little bit more. I hope I have more time to get into an article on Carlucci. He left the CIA after Carter lost the presidency, through people who later went on to work with Ronald Reagan. Then he became deputy director in the Defense Department under Ronald Reagan, from Democratic Party, CIA, Republican Party, Reagan. And he worked there 1981, 82. Then he left the Defense Department and the CIA and worked for Sears, an Sears Roebuck branch, international weapons manufacturer and delivering, and hired Eric von Marbod, who was under a cloud in the 70s, working with General Secord, Theodore Shackley of the CIA, Thomas Kleins of the CIA, Edwin Wilson of the CIA, and Frank Turpel. So he takes von Marbod, who was a partner with those five other people, and works with him several years. And then after the Iran-Contra story comes down, he becomes the National Security Advisor. And in the period where he was working for Sears, von Marbod's partners, Secord, Hakim, Shackley, Kleins. Hakim wasn't in the Egyptian sale. He came in later, but Kleins and Shackley and Wilson's in jail, Turpel's out loose. They were beginning to work, particularly Kleins and Shackley, with the arms from Poland and Portugal for the Iran-Contra affair. And General Secord for Stanford Technology Trading Group, his partners, then worked for the National Security Council. So this is a man who now comes in as the NSC advisor, where he worked 2 years in the CIA with Carter when Carter's election was sabotaged, 2 years for Reagan while the Reagan administration went rolling into power, and then 2 years with Eric von Marbod, and then back as NSC advisor. So if you want to know why the president has cue cards or looks dumb, he is dumb because he said, my responsibility is to tell him what he needs to know. Well, let's see what else Ronald Reagan would see if he picked up the newspapers and Carlucci team, the Secord Hakim group, weren't telling the president what he needs to know. Let's see what he would find. There's an article in the paper this past week where Ronald Reagan was compared to King Lear. Dr. F. Wills, former foreign minister of Guyana, a member of a fact-finding committee on the Commission to Investigate Human Rights in the United States, said Reagan's two feelings were about hostages and Contras. He was uninformed by using reason. King Lear led judgment out and reasons to come in, reasons for doing what he wanted. And this person compared Reagan. He said Reagan had the American Constitution and a written set of rules to obey, and he let the judgment out like King Lear, and his decline happened when he had his reasons for doing it and not his judgment. Incidentally, within the next 2 weeks, I'm going to continue the broadcast I did last week, number 818, on the nomination of FBI Director Judge Sessions, and hopefully then continue and make connections with former FBI Director William Webster, who is now CIA Director. Their links to the murder of Martin Luther King and John Kennedy, to the Nugenhand Bank, to the secret team, to Edwin Wilson, and the murder of the Judge John Wood, who was prosecuting drug dealers. And also next week, I want to give you a detailed analysis of Private Ralph William Myers' airplane trip over Reagan's Eagle's Nest in Santa Barbara, the Reagan helicopter, I call it the Reagan helicopter message that he got, the hints in the news about Bay of Pigs and Donald Nixon and Robert Vesco, Nancy Reagan's desire for a Nobel Peace Prize for her president, and the picture I've put together of that airplane incident in Santa Barbara, which is by far more important than many people might give it the importance of being. And I'll detail that for you. I started outlining it, and I'll do more next week. So let's continue now with what Reagan would see if Frank Carlucci weren't screening for him, and I'll do as many articles of importance that I literally took at random, first one, first on, is enough to fit the sheet of 10 by 14, what would he see in the news? The first is Richard Danner died. He was the hotel manager in Las Vegas who gave Howard Hughes cash to Richard Nixon as a candidate. He also worked with Robert Mayhew, who was the key person in the Christic Institute suit is filed that begins with Robert Mayhew in 1959. This article came out just this past week on Danner's death. It was in the L.A. Times, August the 7th. On television, if Reagan were allowed to listen, Larry King and Daniel Sheehan of the Christic Institute shared a program. Larry King didn't have the guts to have Sheehan on alone, taking the answers or calls himself. He was so spineless, so he had a guest, George Carver, formerly with the CIA for many years, approximately 26 years, dividing the time with Daniel Sheehan, who has very rare time, precious time, on a coast-to-coast program. And the guest, George Carver, they announced, was of the Olin Foundation. He had a grant for studying terrorism or whatever it was. I have the tape. I have to play back the introduction. But what I heard was the Olin Foundation funds, and he works out of the Center for Strategic International Studies. That program was last Monday, August the 10th, 1987. I don't even know if Daniel Sheehan knows this yet, but George Carver's Olin Foundation ties into the very people that the Christic Institute is trying to pinpoint as the source of the problems in their affidavit. Albert Hakim, the key man over General Secord, who purchased Mr. Otto von Bolschwing, I call it a slip of a tongue, Adolf, think of Hitler, Otto von Bolschwing's TCI Corporation, Albert Hakim worked for Olin Foundation. He worked for William Simon, and Olin Foundation money that went to him, approximately $6 million, he got more, was to bribe Iranian officials. The Olin Foundation funds are managed by William Simon, who's a Knight of Malta. He's on the board of Accuracy and Media. He's on Reagan's Foreign Intelligence Advisory Board. He's the head of AmeriCares that funds the Contras. The Olin Foundation came from a giant chemical and weapons conglomerate. Well, Albert Hakim pocketed and profited at least $1 to $6 million and many more that were mentioned in a suit in New England a while back, and came to California and bought the California network of Helene Von Damm, a translator for that network while she was Reagan's appointment secretary. Then she went to the White House for 2 years after that. Helene Von Damm, 6 years rather. So when a person with an Olin Foundation grant is sharing time with Mr. Sheehan, Danny Sheehan, who's the attorney prosecuting this well-known case from the Christic Institute against the Iran-Contra killers, drug runners, and so forth, Larry King has a guest on to eat up the time and to put down what is being said by Daniel Sheehan and the listeners who call in. Another article Reagan might like to see is by Christopher Hitchens. It was in Nation Magazine, August the 1st, 1987, and he begins the article by comparing Oliver North to Adolf Hitler's Freikorps. Well, if he looked a little carefully into the history books, there are direct links of Oliver North to the Freikorps and the persons who killed off political candidates from the time period of 1919 until 1933 when Hitler became president. Another article interesting from the Miami Herald by Alfonso Shardi. He's without a doubt the greatest person on the Iran-Contra affair, and week after week he puts out marvelous articles. This is called Memos Detail High-Level Infighting, Foreign Policy Battle from May 14, 1982. And this is a good story on the people in the White House shifting gears. Reagan was in 1.5 years as president. He didn't bite the bullet in March of 81, neither did the Pope in May of 81. But by May 82, the CIA, William Casey, George Shultz were all infighting terribly, as they were the first month that Reagan was president, and setting the team members in operation that became the Iran-Contra affair players. A story by Lou Cannon, who follows the president, Sans a Mercury, August the 10th. It's titled, This Lame Duck Can Run. And in it, he compares Ronald Reagan to a magician or to the great Houdini. I've said on the air or with friends and other shows broadcast that, and on the telephone many times, that Ronald Reagan's affairs handling this whole Iran operation are similar to that Copperfield who makes the Statue of Liberty disappear, or Houdini. And it's interesting to see these comparisons written by Lou Cannon, who follows him, because these are the two states of mind, the things that I see when I think like a quick Rorschach, Reagan, Iran-Contra, I think of magician and the great Houdini. A story came out in March, it was March 5th, 1987, Washington Post. CIA Deputy Chief McMahon resigns, leaving way for more active policy in the Third World. He didn't like the way the CIA was going. He said there was more money for covert actions than for actual information gathering. The White House didn't want information. This article talks about $500 million that would be in the control, and probably still is, of Richard Perle, because McMahon resigned. Perle, Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy. And then Robert Gates became the deputy under William Casey when McMahon conveniently resigned. And he was a specialist in Soviet studies, chief intelligence on the National Security Council, then became deputy director of the CIA. When Gates was nominated to become CIA director, there was very little about his being, or at least I didn't see it, being on the National Security Council before. Now, the Washington Post story said McMahon went up through the ranks. He worked on the U-2 spy plane. I might add that so did Edwin Wilson, who's part of that whole von Marburg, Secord Shackley Klein's group. So did Lee Harvey Oswald at the Minsk Radio Factory. So did James McCord with his 16-man unit emergency team that would activate a martial law plan in 1971-72. And so did Reverend Ed Butler, who was working at Lockheed, then moved up to Idaho to become head of the Aryan Nations. They were all active in the U-2 program, and of course the purpose of that was to break D'Entente and stop Eisenhower from meeting with the Russians, and it worked. Another story this week, early arms help to Iran, Israeli tie known to the CIA, early arms help to Iran, Israel tie known to the CIA. This is a long article. Also mentioning the arms help came in 1981. This has to do with the hostage rescue. It came out in the San Jose Mercury, August the 9th. It also came out in the Miami Herald. It's about the October surprise. The Miami Herald has a picture of Barbara Honegger, who lives here in Pacific Grove, California. If you send $10, she'll send you her papers and facts, almost a mini book on Reagan's stolen election. Her address is 101 14th Street, Pacific Grove, California, 93950, and she's also worked on the articles impeachment for Ronald Reagan. Many of you might have read the book Prescription for Disaster, or you might not have. It's about the Challenger going down, written by Joseph Trento. And in this book, he cites the fact that astronaut Krista McAuliffe, the late Krista, was muzzled about speaking around the NASA people or privately on her admiration for President John Kennedy. And in this book, he mentions that NASA's official boss, James Beggs, said that the White House was very upset and that Deaver stopped it, that she couldn't publicly say her admiration for John Kennedy. Now, we keep hearing about La Prensa down in Nicaragua, and we can't have peace talk in Nicaragua unless they have free speech. But this president of the United States wouldn't allow an astronaut to praise another president of the United States, even though when he gives speeches, he quotes John Kennedy because he wants to sound like John Kennedy. He doesn't have the head of him, but he doesn't want an astronaut to say that she admired a former president who happened to be a Democrat. The New York Times had a long article this past March, which I've saved and haven't yet put on the air, so some of these dates go back, but I just pulled them out this week because I don't want to miss not sharing them with you. The title of the article is Under Carlucci, the Word is Process. And it's in this article that it says Frank Carlucci was deputy director of CIA under Jimmy Carter, and this is when the debate papers were stolen and when the hostage rescue was sabotaged. Also, Frank Carlucci, as I said, was deputy director of the Pentagon, 1981 and 82, and the people who helped in the taking the Carter papers for the president or sabotaging the rescue operation, Edwin Meese, Richard Allen, William Casey, Frank Carlucci, and General Secord all got top appointments after the election was successful, and they succeeded in ruining Jimmy Carter so that they could be in office. And then Meese becomes the Attorney General, he's Chief of Staff, Richard Allen was National Security Advisor, William Casey's CIA Director, Carlucci, deputy of under the Defense Department under Weinberger, and General Secord was given the operations through Willard Zucker and Lake Resources for the Iran-Contra arms. Now, Albert Hakim, who joined this gang after Iran was overthrown and Khomeini came in power, he came to California, as I say, with the Stanford Technology Training Group, and with the millions of dollars was it the Olin money that he bought the TCI Corporation that Von Dahm was translator for that worked with Reagan, that has direct links through people like Edward Teller of Star Wars and Western Goals and Ronald Reagan's Star Wars operations. The money that Hakim had when he came to California set up what became the operational arm of the White House when Ronald Reagan was elected, and Hakim worked with Secord, who was in on the Iran hostage, and also Oliver North moved into the NSC when Reagan became president and high up in the NSC, and he was also on the border of Turkey and the Iranian border at the time of the hostage rescue. It didn't also include in this article, the one from the New York Times, March 30th, it says, with Carlucci on the National Security Council is Sven Kramer, a hardline arms control expert, who has been an ally of the defense system. Now, Gates was in the NSC, then he goes to the CIA. Carlucci's with the CIA. Then he goes to the Defense Department. Oliver North is with the Defense Department. Then he goes to the NSC. And Sven Kramer seems to be the liaison of the NSC to the defense, to the president. He's the son of Anton Gustav Fritz Kramer of the Pentagon National Security Council. Star Wars partner Daniel Graham, he shares spaces with him. The mentor of Kissinger in Hague. And remember in February, Evans and Novak wrote about the saving grace of the NSC was that Carlucci was keeping Sven Kramer on. And his article tells as if we didn't need to know about his hardline work in the Defense Department. Another long article from the Miami Herald by Alphonse Chardy, it is April the 1st, 1987. CIA is airdropping Contra for the Contra saboteurs. While the Boland Amendment was activated, they wanted to be very sure that Americans weren't doing the material, so they hired the mercenaries from Rhodesia, from Belgium, and then the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers stood outside in Honduras, El Salvador, and directed their mercenaries from London and so forth to sabotage and blow out the electricity. And the story of what they did is horrendous. This article is a very complete article on that matter. If you can get Miami Herald, Alfonso Chardet. If Reagan would like to read the news, I have some more stories we could share or he might see. A long article, magazine length, in Daily News Digest, a weekly review of world events that comes out of Phoenix, Arizona, called AIDS Man-Made. And it goes on to say, don't believe it, that it might not be man-made, and the reasons for that are stated. The publication is Volume 13, Number 32, P.O. Box 39027, Phoenix, Arizona, 85069. And that is why I say tape record these programs. You can erase them later, because these addresses you're going to get not on the telephone by calling my house. I'm not going to look them up. And you can get them by taping the broadcast and writing them over or writing them down as I go. A lot of articles have come out on the death squads in Los Angeles. The Guardian had a long one, July 28, 1987. Death squads invade Los Angeles. Their death threats against the El Salvadorian activists. And a gentleman in charge of the Immigration and Naturalization Services in L.A., I don't have his name, I didn't bring it to the station, he said that the El Salvadorians were doing this to get attention and they weren't getting these threats, and members of Congress have challenged this person on saying that. There have been quite a long series of obituaries and articles. Final tribute to Jesse Unruh, Big Daddy of California politics. Los Angeles Herald had a nice one. This was August the 10th, 1987. You people on the East Coast, Northwest, South, other than the L.A. area particularly, and in California, are not aware of Jesse Unruh. He headed the John Kennedy the election victory in 1960 in California and helped run the nomination in the election. He was in the Ambassador Hotel when Senator Robert Kennedy was murdered. He ran against Reagan for governor and lost. He dies of cancer, and the other old goat, who's had a few operations, is still surviving and is plenty mean. We'll take a one-minute break and then run down some news stories that the president might see if Frank Carlucci didn't tell him what he needed to know for 30 minutes a day.